Skip ahead 30 or seconds if the resources I've been giving bother you. And thank you all for your support and encouragement. I won't stop. Here they are again. There is a crisis text line set up for those suffering from anxiety or depression. Text 741-741 for help. If you are experiencing suicidal thoughts, please call the National Suicide Hotline at 1-800-273-TALK or 8255. If you are suffering from domestic violence, please call 1-800-799-SAFE or 7233 or dial 911 and just leave the line open. Remember, you are not alone. I'll have international resources as well as these U.S. numbers in today's show notes. Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Oh, can't you see? You belong to me. How my poor heart aches with every step you take. Every move you make and every vow you break, I'll be watching you. The Stalker Anthem, Every Breath You Take, really captures the psychopathy of Elsie Underwood. He was controlling and abusive to every woman he ever had a relationship with. He really did know every move they made. And when they pulled away from him, he always played the victim. It was never his fault. The narcissist always gaslights his victims. Even though he treated women he supposedly loved like property, it was their fault that he terrorized them. And as a police officer, he also used his uniform to manipulate women. They knew he held the power. If they told the truth, they wouldn't be believed because he was a cop. And it worked the other way as well. That uniform stood for safety and trust. Elsie wouldn't really hurt me. He's a policeman. He wielded that uniform as viciously as he did a gun. Welcome to episode 99, Every Move You Make, Double Murderer, Elsie Underwood, part 2. As we get into part 2 of this case, I again want to thank author and retired detective sergeant and chief of police, Paula May, and her publisher, Wild Blue Press. Ms. May's publishing team reached out to me and offered her book, First Degree Rage, The True Story of the Assassin, An Obsession, and Murder, for use as a primary source for this episode. It is an excellent book, and I will have a special link for you to purchase the book in today's show notes. Last week, I had just finished telling you about Elsie Underwood's third wife, Marcia, and about how she inadvertently helped her ex-husband stalk another woman. Of all the women in his life, Elsie seemed to maintain his hold over Marcia. He was cruel to her, but he could also manipulate her, make her feel sorry for him. Elsie had gotten the job with the Salisbury Police Department when he was married to Marcia. It was her hometown, and he seemed happy to move. He resigned from Lincoln County and was immediately hired at Salisbury. Then he was a Salisbury police officer for 8 years. One of his supervisors at Salisbury was Wayne Whitman, and he introduced Elsie to his neighbor, Kay Whedon. He seemed to believe that Elsie was separated or already divorced. Either way, it was clear to everyone that he and Marcia lived separate lives. Kay Whedon was born in 1952, so she would have been around 38 when she met Elsie Underwood in early 1990, when he was still certainly married, but she didn't know that. She had married a man named Matthew Whedon and was a teacher living in Northern Virginia when she had her son Jason in 1977. So Jason would have been around 13 when Elsie came into their lives. Kay divorced after 13 years of marriage and moved to Salisbury. She had been born in Rowan County, so it was her hometown. She was a sweet woman, pretty, with short blonde hair. And she was a really busy woman, a dedicated teacher, but she was also absolutely devoted to her son. She spent her weekends at his soccer games and was close to her mother, who also lived in Salisbury, Catherine Miller. Kay lived in a nice neighborhood, in a brick, ranch-style home. Next to her wide driveway, she had a small patch of land where she had a fire pit surrounded by patio chairs. It was landscaped and her own little piece of heaven. She loved to sit with her son at night around the fire, often letting Jason invite his friends over. She went out with her friends also, but she didn't really date. She wasn't sure she was ready. But when she met Elsie Underwood, like so many women before her, she was impressed. He was the ultimate perfect gentleman, just as he was always described. He opened car doors, bought her flowers, he took her out to nice restaurants, and he always paid. She noticed something else, something that previous girlfriends and colleagues and friends of Elsie's noticed. He was extremely neat. A smoker himself, he would clean an ashtray the minute one cigarette butt was put out in it. He was meticulous. Later, when Detective Sergeant Paula May was finally able to search Elsie's home, she said to an SBI agent, "Does this remind you of anything?" He said, "What?" She said, "The home in Sleeping with the Enemy, the Julia Roberts film." In the film, Julia Roberts' abusive husband had insisted on a meticulous home, even down to the kitchen cabinets. Paula opened a cabinet and noticed every can was faced forward in exact rows. "I have to tell you, I saw this movie in theaters. It's not exactly a horror movie, but after the Julia Roberts character runs away and she feels safe in her new home, she opens her cabinets one day and sees that someone has perfectly organized the canned goods. When she opens the cabinets, the entire audience in the theater screamed as if a monster had jumped out. The monster was her abusive ex-husband, and she knew he had found her." Evidently, that movie resonated with Paula May as well. Elsie's home gave her the creeps. But when he and Kay began dating, everything seemed fine, even if he seemed a bit possessive and always had to have everything his way. Kay said that he resented her friends, and especially her son, whining to her that he would always come second after Jason. She tried to explain that that wasn't true. Of course her son meant the world to her, but she did love Elsie, and she didn't understand this jealousy. She often suggested that he go out with his own friends, but he insisted he just wanted to be with her. He was obsessive. "If you love me, you should feel the same way," he told her all the time. But Kay maintained her boundaries, or tried to. She definitely pushed back, which enraged Elsie. She felt smothered by his insecurity and often tried to end the relationship. She knew he was trying to control her. But also, like the women before her, Elsie had a way of sweet-talking his way back in. But her mother, Catherine Miller, seemed to have seen Elsie for what he was. The sweet little old lady, who at 77 still worked 40 hours a week while still remaining active in her church, really did dote on her daughter. And she definitely noticed how Elsie treated her daughter and grandson. Kay recalled her mother even tactfully, as she put it, admonishing Elsie. She didn't just tell Kay about her worries. She wasn't afraid to stand up to Elsie herself, even if she did it politely. Kay always said he seemed ashamed and did not answer her mother or engage in an argument when she did fuss at him. In the summer of 1992, when their relationship was definitely strained, Elsie talked Kay into a romantic weekend getaway in the mountains. When they arrived at the small inn, there was a large bouquet of sunflowers in the room. The card on the flowers read, "Will you marry me?" She turned around and Elsie showed her a ruby and diamond engagement ring. She accepted his proposal, hoping that this was a fresh start. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Kay noticed during their romantic getaway that Elsie seemed very familiar with the small town. a town that was just across the Blue Ridge Parkway, where Victor Gunnarsson's body would later be found. He gave himself away by bitching about his ex-wife, Marcia, while he was there for Kay. He had definitely come here with his ex-wife. At least, Kay thought Marcia was his ex-wife. They would not divorce officially for another year. Kay's optimism and happiness soon faded. Elsie could rarely keep up the facade of a normal, loving man for long. Just a few weeks later, Kay broke off the engagement and gave him back the ring. Later that summer, Kay went to a club with her friend Vicky to go out dancing. She knew that Elsie knew the place, because for all of his whining about his back, Elsie loved to dance. But the club was in the town of Cornelius, and she didn't expect to see him there that night. Unfortunately, Elsie was already there with another mutual friend of theirs. He saw Kay first and immediately came over, pushing his way between her and Vicky, ignoring Vicky and insisting that Kay dance with him. She said no several times, getting louder, and then he tried to yank her arm. He said, "If you don't dance with me, I'm going to say something you won't like to your fat friend Vicky." Kay was in tears, humiliated, embarrassed, and horrified at how Elsie had treated her friend. She and Vicky just got up and left. As they walked out, Elsie yelled, "You're a fat bitch," to Vicky, who just ignored him. He and the friend also left at the same time, but Kay and Vicky decided to sit in her car for a bit, hoping to lose Elsie. She did, for then. In October of 1992, she accepted a date with a nice man named Johnny. When he drove her home that night, Elsie's car was in her driveway. She told Johnny to back up and take her to Vicky's, where she called Jason and told him to lock the doors because Elsie was outside of the house. After Jason assured her the doors were locked and he wasn't scared, she spent the night with Vicky. When she called her house the next morning, Elsie answered the phone. He had snuck in without Jason knowing. He was gone by the time she got there, but she saw that he had rummaged through her purse and had even stolen some mail. When she called to confront him, he denied stealing her driver's license or anything else and begged her to meet him, just to talk. She did, and like the women before her, she let his charm and seemingly sincere apologies get to her. She let him back into her life. She was cautiously back in the relationship, but watchful. Around Thanksgiving, Elsie seemed particularly maudlin. She tried to cheer him up, calling him often, but nothing worked. This would be Thanksgiving of 1992, more than a year before the murders. When she couldn't get him on the phone, she got worried, and she and Jason went to see him. She could see him sitting in the recliner through the window, but he wouldn't answer the door. So Kay called a police officer friend of Elsie's, who banged on the door until he did answer, angrily saying he had been taking a crap, even though Kay knew she had seen him sitting in the recliner. Still, she invited him to Thanksgiving dinner with Jason and her mother, even though he whined that her mother didn't like him. But the next day, he again didn't answer the phone, so she and Jason went to his house. This time, she decided to use the key she had and let herself in with Jason on her heels. Elsie was in bed and she couldn't wake him. She was scared, but she saw that he was breathing. She turned some music up really loud and he finally stirred. And then he pulled a gun on her. He told her coldly to get out. She said she wasn't leaving until she knew he was okay. So then he pointed the gun straight at Jason. Jason yelled, "Go ahead and shoot." Kay screamed, and Elsie dropped the gun. Kay told her 15-year-old son to get out of there and drive the car home. He didn't have a driver's license, but he did know how to drive. Jason did not want to go, but he left as his mother insisted. Kay later said she stayed because she was afraid Elsie would kill himself. She finally left, had Thanksgiving with her mom and Jason, and tried to put it all behind her. Elsie called a few days later and blamed his behavior on the prescription medication he took for his back. She wasn't sure she believed him, and told him he needed to get psychiatric help, which, as he pleaded with her to forgive him, he agreed to. She said, "You get some help and we can talk." He did actually see a counselor for a few weeks and seemed better. Kay continued to date him on into the winter of 1993. She felt like he was better, thoughtful. He even gave her his toaster when hers broke. He said, "I never use it anyway," and it seemed like a sweet gesture to her. She was again hopeful until a few weeks later, when Elsie barged in and weirdly demanded his toaster back. He was wearing bedroom slippers and had stains on his clothing. She later said his eyes were so strange, like they were all pupils. Elsie had brown eyes, but on this night, they were completely black. There are many drugs that can make your pupils dilate, especially amphetamines. Paula May, a deeply religious woman, would later see those eyes and feel they were demonic. Kay again broke it off with Elsie after this incident, and in March of 1993, after a bad snowstorm, she was home from school with her son. She taught English and drama at West Rowan High. But that day was a snow day. Kay had ordered Jason a waterbed. A doctor had recommended it to help with Jason's frequent soccer injuries. The new bed happened to arrive that day when they were both home, and she and Jason spent the day rearranging his room and setting up his new bed. His old bed had sat below the window in his room, which was drafty. The new waterbed was bigger, and they set it up on the opposite wall. The next morning, Jason told his mom that he had slept really well. Kay walked outside, happy that Jason was happy, to go to work. As she opened her garage door and walked in, she was horrified to see that someone had vandalized her new car with red spray paint. I'm not sure what was written, except that it was ugly expletives on the windshield and exterior of her car, and it looked as though the doors had been kicked in. Kay called the sheriff, and she also called Elsie. She would later insist that as a police officer, she couldn't believe that Elsie would do these things to her. Elsie played the hero and said it looked like the work of juveniles, which the deputy who was dispatched agreed with. She called and arranged for repairs and a paint job and called her insurance company before she got to work. She was very upset. The next morning, she walked out and realized she had left her garage door open. Before she pulled out of the driveway, she closed the garage door and saw more vandalism. "Jason is a fag" was scrawled in large red spray-painted letters on her door. She filed another police report and again told Elsie. He called her later that day and told her he had received an anonymous threat against Jason. The next day, Elsie claimed he received an anonymous note that said, quote, "Johnny did it." Remember, Kay had a date with a man named Johnny. A man who never called her again after the drama Elsie caused that night. Elsie said the letter was left on the counter at the Salisbury Police Department. When Kay asked for it a few days later, Elsie claimed he couldn't find it. 5 days later, someone shot bullets into the outside wall outside of Jason's room, exactly in the place where his bed used to sit. They didn't notice the shots at the time. Jason heard nothing. But the house had been egged overnight. Kay again called Elsie, who told her not to worry. It was kids. But she did worry, and the next day she received an anonymous threatening letter in her mailbox. The letter was particularly hateful towards Jason, saying he should watch his back and asking if he liked fire, hinting that soon their house would be set on fire. Then it said, quote, "Betty didn't know that his house was shot over the weekend, so you might want to look for bullet holes." The letter accused Jason of being a drug user and said that other students hated him, but Kay knew her son was popular. And while he might have experimented smoking pot, he was no drug addict. Jason was a good kid. Also, as an English teacher, she felt certain the letter was too sophisticated to have been written by a student. She graded English papers all the time, This felt wrong. But she still didn't suspect LC. She just made another police report. The next day, she got an anonymous call where a male caller yelled, quote, "You tell your faggot son I want my $2,000. When she asked why, the caller yelled, "For drugs." LC continued to play innocent and even acted like a victim himself, saying his house had also been egged. Kay never saw any evidence of this at LC's house, but shrugged it off, remembering how neat and clean he was. He had probably immediately cleaned up the eggs. But she and Jason did eventually find bullet holes outside his wall and one that came through his room and hit his dresser. The teen had apparently slept through it. And Kay kept getting prank calls, and so did Jason on his private line. She got another letter reading, "Roses are red, violets are blue. We are going to fuck Jason and your house too." At this, Kay's mother, Catherine, had enough. She hired a private detective to watch her daughter's house. $4,000 for 9 days. Jason was gone to visit his father for spring break during this time. Naturally, Kay told LC about this too. Again, while she had her issues with him personally, as a police officer, it was difficult for her to believe he had anything to do with this. For those 9 days, it was quiet. Incidentally, Elsie asked her where the PI was staked out. Then he jeered after the 9 days that the PI was a total waste of money. Kay was relieved there was no incident, but she did not connect it to the fact that Elsie knew a PI was watching. She later said that during all of this, she failed to notice Elsie was no longer interested in her sexually. When she did think about it, she found it odd, but was too worried to focus on it. But later, when she did ask him about it, he blamed it on medication. Further investigation would reveal he would often become impotent with the women he became serious with. Law enforcement came to Kay and said that after much investigation, they believed LC was responsible for the vandalism and anonymous letters. On April 29, 1993, LC was suspended without pay, pending the investigation into the threatening letters sent to Kay. By then, he had been working as a resource officer at the high school where Kay worked, supposedly due to his back injury. Police had matched the typewritten letters to a specific typewriter and ribbon at the school where he and Kay worked. It belonged to a woman LC had befriended. The woman, named Anne, told Kay about many inappropriate statements Elsie had made to her. He called black kids the N-word, and others little faggots, like he had Jason. Kay still couldn't believe it, even after she found out the SBI had tested the typewriter ribbon. It's easy in hindsight to think that Kay was naive or blind to what Elsie was doing, but you have to remember, he was still acting like he was her rock. He was acting protective and worried for her. She thought he was real police. She really didn't understand that he was a predator. Soon, Elsie was asked to take a polygraph. He refused. He gave the standard excuse any guilty person does for not taking the test. He was on medication. He was upset. This was a witch hunt. By May of 1993, Elsie showed up with his attorney to take the polygraph. The test wasn't just inconclusive. He failed. The Salisbury police tried to explain this to Kay, who still had trouble believing it, even though she was no longer really dating LC. Kay just could not believe it was LC terrorizing her. And of course, he was playing on her past feelings for him and pressuring her to help him get out of trouble. And it worked. She wrote a letter to the Salisbury police, formally asking them to end the investigation into her ex-boyfriend. And then she started seeing him again. In June, the chief put a disciplinary action against LC. He would be suspended for 5 days without pay. He was to be demoted to a patrol officer, and he was no longer assigned as resource officer at Kay's school. He also had to undergo a psychological evaluation to determine if he was fit for duty. By late that summer of 1993, their relationship was again deteriorating, and Kay was trying to end it. She started cutting him off. And her mother encouraged her, constantly reminding her that she deserved better. After a few months, Kay again accepted a new date. She went with a man named David to a restaurant in Salisbury. Within a few minutes, Elsie appeared at their table. He yelled, "I'll kill you, boy," to her date, and then picked up Kay's glass of iced tea and dumped it into her lap. He had a friend with him who he pointed out to Kay and her date and said he was another police officer. His unwitting friend had no idea what he was getting into when he had agreed to go for drinks with Elsie. The manager called the police, but by then, Elsie had fled. A deputy escorted Kay back to her house. Elsie's friend, back at his house, was trying to calm him down. Elsie had a small Sheltie dog named Misty that Kay had given him as a Christmas gift the year before. He supposedly loved the little dog, but he was so angry, pacing and ranting this night, that he kicked the crate Misty was cowering in, scaring the little dog. His friend told him to stop, telling him that sweet little dog hadn't done anything to him. Elsie said, "Kay gave Misty to me, and she reminds me of her." Not long after, Kay had another personal run-in with Elsie at a convenience store. He had obviously followed her to the store on her way to school. He blocked her in with his car and then grabbed Kay and jerked a necklace off of her neck. He screamed, "I bought you this necklace." Kay went on to school. She had a drama club event at a local college and intended to remain professional. As she came out of the auditorium, she found a letter from Elsie on her car, again, begging her to come back to him. He had not just followed her to her job, but to an off-campus event. At this, Kay was done. She decided to go to the magistrate the following morning. She called her mother and asked her to go with her. Catherine calmly said, "Okay, dear." Kay learned that, unfortunately, despite a North Carolina law passed in 1979 about domestic violence, she could not be protected. Because she was not married to Elsie and did not live with him, she was ineligible for a protection order. The magistrate even told her that because Elsie was a police officer, having him arrested could only make things worse. Elsie could lose his job, he said. Frustrated, Kay and her mother went straight to Elsie's police chief with the Salisbury department. He said he was sorry to hear about that, but he would not say he would do anything about it. Kay was stunned and upset. Later, talking to Paula May, she said she knew people judged her for not acting more quickly against Elsie. Kay had originally defended Elsie and asked the police to stop investigating him for the threatening letters. But now she was reporting him, and they refused protection because of a loophole in the law about domestic violence. If it seems crazy, it is. When Paula May talked to her about this incident, she could not hold back her opinion. Elsie had been stalking her and should have been arrested. They did have a stalking law on the books. Not to mention, when he grabbed her and yanked the necklace off, that was assault and robbery. Paula was floored. It looked like the police were protecting their own. However, that November, Elsie's chief did begin an internal investigation into his stalking and threatening of Kay Whedon. And within a few weeks, Elsie Underwood retired on disability for his alleged back problems. Paula was later told it was the simplest way to get him off of the police force, but he should have been held criminally responsible. Perhaps if the Salisbury police had charged him rather than giving him retirement, the chain of events in this tragedy could have been stopped. On Black Friday, after Thanksgiving of 1993, Kay went to a club with some friends and was introduced to a tall, dark-haired man named Victor Gunnarsson. He was 40 years old, handsome, charming, with beautiful bright blue eyes. There was an instant attraction, but Kay, understandably, moved slow. Victor, however, was also instantly smitten. He He came to a soccer awards assembly with one of his friends to sit with Kay and applaud her son on November 29th. On Wednesday, December 1st, Victor called and offered to cook dinner for Kay and Jason. She accepted, and they had a lovely dinner. They saw each other casually, usually with other friends, each night that week around Thanksgiving. On December 3rd, Kay was supposed to have dinner with her mother at a seafood restaurant. She called her mother and asked if she could invite Victor. Her mom said, "Of course, I want to meet him." They were very close, and Kay had told her mother all about the handsome Swede. They met at Blue Bay Seafood Restaurant around 6:30 that night. They had a nice time, though Catherine did say that Victor, an extreme intellectual who spoke 8 languages, did kind of talk over her head. But she could see her daughter was happy, and Victor otherwise seemed like a very nice, charming man. He drove Kay home, where she shyly asked him to come into her bedroom. Sometime later, Jason arrived home with friends, and they asked if they could build a fire in the fire pit. Victor was excited about the fire pit, and they all sat around it, talking, laughing, and having a good time. Kay and Victor held hands, watching the flickering flames. A car drove by and turned left near her house. And Jason said, "Monte Carlo," identifying the car. Elsie drove a burgundy Monte Carlo. Kay, while tense, tried to ignore it and enjoy her evening. At around 11:30 p.m., Victor excused himself, apologizing that he was exhausted because he had taken a friend to the airport early that morning. It wasn't a lie. Victor had driven his friend Daniel to the airport that morning before his evening with Kay. Daniel arrived in Sweden early the following day and tried to call his friend, as promised, to let him know he arrived safely. He got no answer. And Kay Whedon did not get a promised call either. She was sure that the attraction was not one-sided, so she tried not to let it bother her, chalking it off to men being forgetful creatures. Victor had happily promised to go and get a Christmas tree with her and help her decorate it that Saturday. By 5:30, she was tired of waiting and called her friend Vicky to go to dinner with her. By Sunday, she decided to go get the tree herself, but she did try to call Victor, deciding not to play it safe, and got his answering machine. She left a casual message, no pressure. As soon as she hung up, the phone rang, and she answered eagerly, expecting it to be Victor. It was Elsie, informing her that he was picking her up at 7 o'clock that night and was going to bring her back to his house and make love to her. Kay, not in the mood for a fight, said no, she had plans. She even said she was just going to get her Christmas tree. And then she hung up on him. She called the friend who had set her up with Victor and asked if she wanted to go Christmas tree shopping. She told the friend that Victor had stopped calling her, and the friend, named Tana, suggested they drive by his apartment. His car was there. The door to his apartment was even ajar. Kay and Tana looked around inside but didn't find Victor and decided to leave. Kay didn't want him to find her there. Tana had given her some photographs of her and Victor and friends. So Kay returned, and she wrote on the envelope, "Pictures for you, Tana and Kay," and this time closed the door, wedging the pictures in. She noticed that Victor's answering machine was blinking and looked to have several messages. She had no way of knowing his friend Daniel had been calling several times a day, worried for his friend. Elsie kept calling her the next couple of days, always jealously asking her what she was doing and who she was with. He even knew about the seafood dinner she had with her mother and Victor, and she didn't deny it when Elsie asked her about the dinner. He said, "Did your mother like him?" Kay, sick of his shit, said, "She liked him okay." Elsie said, "I bet, especially since your mother hates me." It was always poor, pitiful, picked-on Elsie. Kay was so tired of his whining. This went on for the next couple of days, and Kay continued to ignore him. On Tuesday, December 7th, Kay had planned to sleep in and take Jason for his driving exam. Instead, The phone awoke her at 6:45 a.m. It was Elsie calling, saying he had left a letter in her mailbox. She walked outside, retrieved the letter. Then before she could even finish making coffee, her doorbell rang. It was Elsie. She didn't feel like arguing, so she just let him in. He was singing the same old song. "We need to talk about our relationship," he whined. She kept saying gently that she didn't want to be in a relationship with him. Then he abruptly told her that Misty died, that the little dog had choked to death on a quarter. Kay was upset and said, "I'm so sorry," and she meant it. It didn't occur to her that he might have killed that sweet little dog. The police found no record of Elsie taking Misty to the vet and never found her body, but she was definitely gone. Elsie had also raged to another friend that he might shoot the dog and throw her body in the woods. It seems as though he did kill that poor little dog. Elsie left, and after a couple of hours, Kay read yet another long rambling letter from him. She woke Jason up and they got his driver's license. Catherine stopped by to wish Jason a happy birthday, but he was already riding around in his new car. She had given him some money for a CD player. Kay had blocked Elsie's number on her phone, but the next day, when she got home from school, she saw missed calls and, with call return, found out it was Elsie when he answered. She was angry, and he kept pushing for her to go to dinner. She kept refusing, but also putting him off, trying not to anger him. He called again, weirdly, acting as though he wanted to make sure she was staying at home. She blew it off and went to bed. The next morning, she went to work as usual. At 9 a.m., she was surprised, and then her stomach dropped when she saw her mother's boss walk into her classroom. Her mother, who never missed work, had not shown up or called. Her boss had already called the sheriff's department, but she jumped in the car with him and they raced to her mother's house. The deputy had to break down the door because Kay didn't have her key. But the door was blocked. The deputy looked around and saw Catherine Miller blocking her door. He knelt down, not pushing the door any further, to feel for her pulse. He smelled blood and burned beans that were on the stove. The 77-year-old grandmother was slumped on the floor near her refrigerator against the door, and there was no pulse. She was cold, and she was gone. I'm going to pause now for a word from today's sponsor. Finding the perfect present for your dad is tough. He might be okay with a corny dad joke t-shirt, but you want to give him something more special. With social distancing, it might be hard this year. And if you're like me, you may have lost your father and need to find another person to celebrate on this bittersweet day. That's why I'm giving someone I love a really meaningful gift this year, StoryWorth. It's an online service that helps your loved ones tell the story of their lives through thought-provoking questions about their memories. This year, for Father's Day, I'm going to give the gift of StoryWorth to my husband. He doesn't live in the same town as his family, so we really cherish spending the holidays with them. He loves to catch up with his parents and siblings, telling childhood stories and laughing. He is also a wonderful father, and I know he will enjoy sharing family members with his kids in the beautiful book StoryWorth will create for him. StoryWorth helps capture those memories and preserve them forever, with weekly emailed questions you'd never think to ask, like, what have been some of your life's greatest surprises? It's the gift of spending time together, wherever you live. Reading the weekly stories is fun and makes us all feel closer, even when we're not together. After 1 year, StoryWorth will compile all the answered questions and photos you have chosen into a beautiful keepsake book that is shipped for free. I know my family will treasure this book forever. Give your dad or any father in your life the most meaningful gift this year with StoryWorth. Get started right away without the need for shipping by going to storyworth.com/southernfried. You'll get $10 off your first purchase. That's storyworth.com/southernfried for $10 off. The officer who found Catherine Miller's body immediately backed out of the house and called his superiors. Soon, the scene was covered with police cars. Catherine Miller had suffered 2 gunshot wounds to the head, and there was no sign of forced entry. Kay knew she always kept her storm door locked. but it had been open when they got there. It would seem that Catherine had opened the door to someone she knew, someone who then shot her point blank with the double tap method that police and military use. There were some signs in the house that someone had rifled through Catherine's things, but it looked staged, except that her purse was missing. Kay went home in a daze and was shocked to find out that Jason had gone to LC's house with a friend when he heard the news. Like his mother, despite all LC had done, he was a police officer. It was an instinct to turn to LC because he was so distressed. Jason was still at Elsie's house when he called his mother, and she told him to get out of there immediately. When he got home, he explained that he went over there because Elsie was a cop and he might know something. Despite everything, he didn't believe that Elsie would hurt his grandmother. He told Kay that Elsie had not been all that sympathetic and had just asked Jason if the cops were using tracking dogs. And then he asked Jason if he needed any money, which was strange. He had never been really fatherly or caring towards Jason, and Kay immediately thought of her mother's missing purse. She considered that LC had murdered her mother and was trying to frame Jason. And LC did not attend Catherine Miller's funeral on Monday, December 13th. During the emotional ceremony, Kay experienced something that she felt had come from God. It galvanized her. And later, she felt it gave her the strength to get through the next months and years. That afternoon, she got a phone call from Victor's friend Daniel and found out he had never heard from him. She was now really worried. She had always been doubtful that Victor had blown her off, and now she thought his disappearance was connected to her mother's murder. She remembered that Elsie had driven by her house that night and had seen her holding hands with Victor. She might not have connected the dots at the time, but each time Kay tried to date another man, Elsie lashed out at the man and her. Those had been simple first dates. This time, he had seen Kay intimately with Victor. Horrified, she called the Rowan County Police. Victor Gunnarsson had already been reported missing by his apartment manager. And now the police were very interested in the connection between Victor and Catherine Miller. They interviewed Elsie, who feigned horror and sympathy at Catherine's murder. He kept repeating, "She was a real nice lady." But then, without being asked, Elsie went off on a rant about Jason. He called him a spoiled brat and accused him of actually hitting Kay. He also said that Kay let her son drink alcohol and that she had also hidden his drug habit. It wasn't a good look for a man under suspicion of murder. LC seemed to think he would make the investigators suspicious of Jason, but he was really only sealing his fate as their main suspect. He even brought up several times how often he had been in Catherine Miller's home, helping her out and mowing her yard. He had never done things like that for Catherine. He was just trying to explain away any prints he might have left in her house. He also characterized Kay as the possessive one in the relationship. He said that she harassed him, and he had to block her phone number. On January 5th, 2 days before Paula May was called to the scene where Victor's body was found, Kay agreed to call Elsie and let the police record the call. It was a long, argumentative conversation, and Elsie played the victim, like he always did, blaming the police for putting ideas in Kay's head. But she was firm now. She flat out told Elsie she knew he killed her mother. "And I think you killed your dog too," she said. And then he hung up on her. 2 days later, her friend Tana called Kay to tell her a man's body had been found. They all knew it was Victor, though positive identification would take about a week. So now, Detective Sergeant Paula May of Watauga County's Criminal Division was partnered with Rowan County investigators working on Catherine's murder, as well as the SBI. On January 31st, Paula went before the Superior Court Judge of Watauga County and got a search warrant for Elsie's home and car. Investigators found that Elsie had 12 uniform shirts and 17 pairs of uniform pants that he had never turned in after his forced retirement. just as Paula and other investigators believed that Catherine Miller had opened her door to a man she knew, they now believed that it was likely that Victor, who was very careful about locked doors and strangers appearing at his home due to his past in Sweden, would have opened his door for a uniformed police officer. As they searched Elsie's house, the investigators found a roll of black electrical tape like the kind that had been found near Victor Gunnarsson's body. But eagle-eyed Paula had noticed black electrical tape wrapped around the wiring on the back of Elsie's clothes dryer. It would later be matched to the piece of tape they found at the murder scene. But they never found Elsie's guns, and that was a huge obstacle in the case. They would question each and every person about Elsie's guns and got the same story many times. He did own a .38 caliber, the same type of gun used in Catherine's murder, and a .22, the type used in Victor's. Investigators talked to people for 2 years, collecting circumstantial evidence. They knew that Elsie had called a cop buddy to run Victor's license plate after he saw him that night with Kay. Many of Elsie's former friends talked to investigators. No one was protecting him any longer. They were building a strong case. They even had a confession from a guy who made those threatening phone calls to Kay and Jason on Elsie's behalf. But they needed physical evidence. Despite the strength of the circumstantial evidence, it would be risky to take Elsie to trial without physical evidence. If he was acquitted, double jeopardy would attach. They had impounded Elsie's vehicle, which had been spotlessly clean, and the FBI had all physical evidence for testing in their labs. Just when they were about to lose hope, Paula got a call from the FBI. In October of 1996, an FBI analyst was packing up the evidence to return to local investigators, and while he was placing carpet from Elsie's car trunk into a box outside, he saw, in natural light, what he had never found in the lab. There were hairs embedded deeply in the carpet. Elsie had the carpet shampooed before investigators were able to impound the car. They had spoken to the owner of the car wash. It was a miracle the hair was even there. The hair had roots attached and were so deep in the carpet, police believed that Victor had been alive, but tied up and struggling in that trunk. Elsie had long claimed that he could not have killed Victor and moved his body due to his bad back. But he certainly could have held a gun on him and then marched him through the cold snow, forced him to undress, and then executed him on the spot. It was a chilling image for investigators, and it made the most sense. Paula May, an extremely religious woman, felt it was divine intervention that day. She quotes scripture in her book from John chapter 1, verse 5. God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. It took natural sunlight to show the deeply embedded hairs. When the hairs were tested, they were a microscopic match to Victor Gunnarsson. And soon, they had a mitochondrial DNA match. At trial, it was powerful evidence, as none of Victor's family was in the United States. It could only be his hair. Elsie Underwood was indicted for kidnapping and first degree and the death of Victor Gunnarsson on January 30th, 1997. After he was arrested, Paula intentionally put herself near him in squad cars. She wanted to gauge his reactions. He was extremely polite to her, calling her ma'am in every sentence, while seeming to sneer at the male officers. Since Paula was by now well aware of Elsie's hatred for women, this was bizarre. She would later find out from taped phone calls at the jail that he indeed hated her with a passion. His feigned courtesy was some sort of weird show for her. In hindsight, it might have even been sarcasm. At the time of indictment and arrest for Victor Gunnarsson, the DA planned to prosecute Elsie later for Catherine Miller's murder. Elsie went to trial in June of 1997, and the prosecution got a major break and was allowed to introduce evidence in Catherine Miller's case. It is difficult to get details of other crimes admitted at trial, especially a crime a defendant had not yet been convicted of. but it clearly showed that Elsie's real target was Kay. He murdered Victor out of jealousy, and Catherine probably out of spite because she didn't like him. And both murders would hurt Kay Whedon. The prosecution had easily proven his stalking and terrorizing of Kay and Jason. But it was a risky move on the prosecutor's part, and Elsie would later bring it up in appeals, to no avail. The jury convicted Elsie of the kidnapping and murder of Victor Gunnarsson and sentenced him to life in prison. Investigators, including Paula May, were upset that he did not receive the death penalty. They felt that the jury probably didn't understand that life in prison rarely meant actual life. The jury had asked questions about this, but by rule of law, the judge was not allowed to instruct them. However, life in prison really was life in prison for Lamont Elsie Underwood. He died at the age of 67 in 2018, less than 20 years into his sentence, of natural causes. Elsie Underwood abused, stalked, and terrorized every woman who had ever gotten close to him. At his trial, only Kay Whedon had to testify. All of those women who were so terrified to tell the truth about Elsie were not needed at trial. Investigators had enough evidence and other witnesses to leave his other victims at peace. Elsie put on a mask of charm to seduce women, and then he used his police uniform to confuse and manipulate them. He needed a mask and a costume to hide what he really was. He was a psychopath, a narcissist, a monster. But monsters can rarely hold the mask of normalcy for long. It slips, and the evil peeks out, staring back at you with cold, dead eyes. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Southern Fried's audio is edited by Ches Gray of Gray Multimedia. A huge thank you again to author Paula May. I cannot say enough about her incredible work as lead detective on this case, her passion for victims, and her amazing writing. And what's more, as much as she was a victim's advocate in this case, she always had room in her heart for Elsie as a boy who had been abandoned and abused. She understood the cycle of violence, but she did not excuse it. Don't forget to click on the link in today's show notes to purchase First Degree Rage by Paula May. And thanks to Natalie DeYoung from Ms. May's publishing team, Wild Blue Press, who reached out to me. I found out she has a podcast herself called Spoopy Creppy. Check it out. And remember to subscribe to Fetal Abduction, a true crime podcast. The show premiered last Thursday, and there will be another episode next week. Now you'll have two places to listen to me. And I'd like to remind you to come join my Facebook group. We share memes and have a lot of laughs. It's a really fun community, and we'd love to have you. Hashtag no shit asses allowed. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I'm sorry, but I no longer answer private messages on social media. I manage three platforms, and it's just too overwhelming. But please feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. And to the people of color who are outraged, traumatized, and hurting right now, I stand with you. I'm glad the charges against Chauvin were upgraded to second-degree murder, and also that the other officers have been charged. But our country is broken. We still have so much work to do. If you're a white person, please be an advocate. Listen and help educate others. We all have a responsibility to help change our culture. Justice for George Floyd is just the beginning. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Wash your hands, stop touching your face, and y'all take care.